Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Our show today is close to my heart. I'm taking you on a journey with me as I trace my roots to the community where my ancestors settled in the 1700s, to the lost village of Lilly. But the village of Lilly is no longer standing after residents were forced to leave and make room for the Bluestone Dam.
Just imagine how much rougher they had it than we do, you know, and we cry over nothing sometimes, so I think they were pretty tough, and I take pride in it.
And we'll hear the story of one of the nation's earliest environmental controversies in the 1960s over a proposed dam in eastern Kentucky.
I remember going through line at the supermarket and having people behind me saying, now we're going to save the Red River Gorge, aren't we?
So they were for it.
They wanted to save it.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. First, this news. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. There are more than 700 man-made lakes across the country. Some were made to prevent flooding in populated areas, while others were built to create recreational activities. Today, we'll visit communities that were impacted by dam projects, starting with the story about a community near to my heart. Back in the 1940s, about 40 families were pushed off their land along the Bluestone River in Summers County, West Virginia. Many of these families had lived there for more than 200 years. The federal government told the residents at the village of Lilly they had to make room for a new dam a few miles upstream so it could protect other communities from flooding.
A lot of people, of course, I don't reckon they drug them away screaming and hollering, but, you know, a lot of people was very upset to have to leave up there.
That's Douglas Wayne Harvey with the Summers County Historical Society. He goes by Wayne. He carries with him ancient documents and records, and he knows all kinds of details about our family's history. His gray beard gently moves above his neatly pressed dress shirt as he explains the history.
A lot of people didn't want to leave up there, and didn't want to leave the river, and some of them lived through floods before, and they went right back.
The residents at the village of Lilly were upset for several reasons. First, they were disturbed by how the federal government treated the remains from their ancient cemetery when it was relocated. I visited the cemetery and found marked graves of my family, but there were also rows of unmarked graves with simple sticks and tiny metal rectangles that only identified the remains with a number. But as for the village itself, there's hardly any trace at all. Years ago, families lined the river. There was a schoolhouse and a church. Wayne says his father used to tell stories about the people and happenings in Lilly, like pie suppers.
Now, what's a pie supper? Is that when you just have dessert for supper?
They had various activities at those pie suppers. They'd have, so-called pretty girl and stuff like that, where some girl would make maybe a pie or something, and whoever successfully bid in her pie got to eat the pie with her, and various activities, just things to raise some money and help with the school, you know.
But the pie suppers and farm living as they knew it ended when the Army Corps of Engineers showed up and announced the town would be flooded after the Bluestone Dam was built. The dam has provided flood control for many other communities, including the railroad town of Hinton and Charleston, the state capital. Many of the Lillys and other families who lived in the village moved to Raleigh or Wyoming counties, and come to find out, the land wasn't even flooded. Now it's the property of the National Park Service. So to find out more about where they first lived in this region, I went on a hike to retrace the steps of the Lilly family who were believed to settle this area more than 200 years ago. And I took along my Aunt Kay, who now lives in Kentucky.
This seems so remote, though. Mm-hmm. It seems like they would totally have to be totally self-sufficient, you know?
Kay is my father's older sister. He's passed away now, but sometimes he would tell me that I was just like my Aunt Kay, bold and tough. Well, okay, they just called it a temper when I was younger. But anyway, neither my Aunt Kay nor I had ever been to this place where our family used to live. So So we needed some help getting around and finding our way. So Dave Beery with the National Park Service showed us around.
So we're right at the junction with the Little Bluestone where that comes in and meets the Bluestone River. So we're kind of sitting right here now, and you see the town was all around this area. So it really, I mean, it wasn't, when you say a town, I don't think it was this, all just one spot. It was really spread out over this whole area. Mm-hmm. And then way out into the outlying areas too, you know, lots of little farms all around the area.
Dave says most of the families who lived here were subsistence farmers. They lived off the land and grew most of their food themselves. Apparently, this land along the river was pretty good farmland. Legend has it that the Lillys arrived here with just an axe, a gun, and a Bible.
I mean, I can't even imagine what it would have been like coming down here back in the 1700s. You know, this area was the frontier back then. It was really a wilderness. You had to be pretty resourceful to survive back then. You know, there was nothing here.
We walk over a wooden bridge to get to a trail along the river. This path was the same taken by residents in the village of Lilly. But even before my family came here, the path was used by Native Americans for thousands of years.
So there's actually a lot of history through here. And that's the thing that to me makes it so fascinating, walking these trails. Every time I walk this trail, I think of the, you know, footsteps I'm following, that, you know, thousands of years. The first people were here, end of the last ice age, maybe 10,000 years ago, people were first starting to wander through here. And this was the same route they took. There's not many other places you can walk except for this nice little bench right along the river here. So you're walking in the footsteps of a whole lot of people before us.
Dave says there was likely some fighting between white settlers and the natives. But by the time my people got here, most of the Native Americans who used this land for hunting had already been pushed into other territories. We walk along a path and come to a place where we find a patch of pawpaw trees. Dave says there are apple trees here too, most likely planted by my relatives. As I looked at the pawpaw trees and noticed an apple or two along the trail, I began to get really emotional. Dave says when the Lillys were pushed off their land, they weren't allowed back, not even to pick the apples they planted.
There was orchards down here with apple trees, and he said when the government came in and told them they had to leave, this was early, you know, right around 1940 or so, and then after they got everybody out of here, World War II broke out, and they kind of diverted resources, and they weren't building the dam for a while, so it was years later, in the late 1940s, before they actually came down and built the dam. And according to this person, they didn't let the people that lived here come back into that area again. And one of the things they were really upset about was these apple trees that still had apples on them and weren't being harvested.
And it's interesting that that's what bothered them, is that there was food down here just going to waste.
My daddy never, well, that I can think of, he never wasted anything, and he taught me how to live the same. And I can't help but to wonder if this is part of where that came from, that my family was so resourceful, they just couldn't stand the thought of all these apples, food, just going to waste, rotting on the ground, uneaten.
My thought was that how strong the Lilly clan was and how hardworking they were, you know. I mean, just imagine how much rougher they had it than we do. You know, and we cry over nothing sometimes, so I think they were pretty tough, and I take pride in it.
We find pretty much no trace of the people who lived here more than 70 years ago, but sometimes in the springtime, Dave says he does see daffodils growing here in the middle of the forest.
That kind of touches my heart, but just knowing that some lady had planned them, wanting her house to be pretty, you know, and her marks still here. That's awesome.
The residents of Lilly were compensated for the land they were forced to give up. In 1947, a newspaper in Beckley reported that one farmer was paid $1,750 for his property, which would be comparable to about $30,000 today. So why was the land never actually flooded? Well, according to historians, the engineers miscalculated. Wayne Harvey has some strong words about how he feels the people of Lilly were treated by the government.
A lot of times people that are in positions to make decisions, they're no more intelligent than the regular, common, ordinary man. But they try to paint themselves as being, you know, more intelligent and more important and stuff like that. And they're the leaders of society. And a lot of the time they don't apparently know any more than anybody else. And make some very poor decisions, unwise decisions.
No matter how poor the decision might have been, time and time again, I keep hearing that the Lilies were and still are resourceful, faithful people. And as they lost their land, their homes, and part of their way of life, it was family and faith they held close. They preserved what they could, and it seems that bond between people and family was really what was important to them anyway. And perhaps the chunk of money was the boost that some of us needed to find a better life. The Village of Lily is no longer standing, and the homes weren't preserved by the government. But my family, they've worked to preserve an impressive amount of family records and history. The family even organizes a family reunion that's grown into the largest family reunion in the world, according to the Guinness Book of World Records. There are many descendants, like myself, who live nearby, but some Lilies travel across the world to meet up with family for this reunion in Flat Top in August. Basically, the only other remnant of the town is a church. Of course, the building no longer sits along the bluestone as it did generations ago. It's no longer standing at all, but the church, well, it's up the road in neighboring Jumping Branch. It's a small brick church with a steep gray roof, not unlike hundreds of small churches you might find tucked away rural Appalachian roads. Inside the front door is a modest open lobby. Above the entrance to the congregation, a banner celebrates a history that stretches back more than 200 years. The choir leads the congregation to sing, "On the Christ, solid rock I stand. All other ground is sinking sand." On this Sunday morning, the congregation, dressed in their Sunday best, filled a little more than half the pews. Pastor William Fox says several people are missing. He says the minutes from meetings at the church in the late 1800s show just how poor but faithful church members were.
Many times they had to, you know, kind of collect money the best way to get some. And it's kind of interesting with the minutes. Some of them say some of them gave a penny toward the needs of the church and that type of thing, which is, it's amazing because you see that people really sacrificed a great deal to keep the church going.
My six-year-old son sat next to me during the service, well, whenever he was sitting still, and he helped find the hymn and joined with the rest of the congregation in singing. If you know more about the Village of Lily and would like to share it, send us an email to feedback@wvpublic.org. Mine wasn't the only family pushed off their land to make room for a lake. With hundreds of man-made lakes across the country, thousands of families probably know the struggle. Mary Lynn Evans is a filmmaker who's produced documentaries like The Appalachians, Coal Country, and most recently, Blood on the Mountains. She grew up with her grandparents in West Virginia. In the 1970s, they were forced off their land to make room for the recreational Burnsville Lake.
My grandparents who raised me had over 2,000 acres, and they raised cattle and they raised vegetables for Kroger's and other stores for generations and generations. And in 1977, the Army Corps of Engineers, through eminent domain, took all that land and took our home and all of our outbuildings and our silos.
And it still hurts. It still hurts to lose your home. And
I think through the Appalachians and Coal Country and this film, Blood on the Mountain, You know, it's been my own exploration. Both my grandparents died when I was in my early 20s, but all three of my films are dedicated to them. I don't think that people understand what it feels like when your land is taken from you. Because it's your community that's taken from you. It's your home. It's all you know. And to go out into the other, to the big bad world, you know. I guess my husband says I've spent the last 17 years making documentaries to explain the first 17 years of my life being born and raised here in West Virginia.
Again, that was filmmaker Marilyn Evans, anti-mountaintop removal activist and filmmaker. In this next story, we'll hear from a woman who simply refused to leave her home when the federal government told her the Stonewall Jackson Dam would put her house underwater. Residents were paid for their property, but some people, like Barbara Hevner and her son Bob, didn't leave without a fight.
And I said, well, you may have a sworn oath. And I said, I'll tell you something. I said, I made a covenant with God and a promise that I work for him and I try to stop this whole conglomerate, period.
That's Ms. Hevner in an interview conducted by Michael Klein back in 1984. In that clip, she was telling Michael about her encounter with Ron Dowell, who was a U.S. Marshal in 1984.
I was out there on October the 3rd, and I gave her to like the 12th or 14th, something like that, to move.
The showdown happened in Lewis County, West Virginia, before the dam flooded the town of Roanoke, West Virginia.
You know, that's my responsibility as U.S. Marshal. You know, I had a job to do. And I tried to explain that to her, and she didn't make it any easier.
The morning of the 23rd, I had just gotten up, put on my house coat, had been to bathroom. He wasn't up yet. And just as I was ready to go downstairs, I seen this vehicle come right back past those blue spruce, ball and a jack, and up around that road. I didn't have time to call nobody. I seen this young fella dash from behind my truck around a small building, between the small building and the doghouse. This other fellow at the door. I recognized him. And he said, we're here to take you out. We're going to arrest you. Pouring down the rain. I said, a day like this? And I was holding on to the door to steady myself. It was slippery. He pushed me back into the kitchen. I said, I told you once, and I'm telling you again. I said, I am God's property. Well, after that, and he said, well, we're going to take you out. I said, may I call my attorney? No. You sit down there in that chair. And he left my kitchen, and I was almost sure he had gone to the telephone.
Mm-hmm. I disabled the phone. Just had a penknife. The reason I did that, I felt that it was more important that we kept that situation as calm and as stable as possible. And I knew that if she had an opportunity to call the association members or whatever, then we'd probably end up having a real fight on our hands. I tried to keep it as low-keyed as possible. That's why I only took one other officer, myself, and a matron.
So Bobby said to him, he said, if you so much as lay a hand on my dog or harm him in any way, I'll hold you responsible. Right there's where the scuffle started.
And he said, well, if anything happens to my dog, he said, you'll pay. He said he wasn't leaving. She said they weren't leaving. And I said, well, then we're going to have to take you out. At this point, he became very, very agitated. And I could see it. So I reached back, and I started handcuffing him. And that's when he slugged the officer. And we ended up wrestling to the floor.
They went at him right in his face, just like this. Now, he had a bruise around through here. They twisted his arms. They turned him, arms and hands and wrists and everything. They got him down in the floor. They kicked at him, shoved at him, rubbed his face in the floor. Now, he's hauled cold and not look as bad as he did when he got up off that floor that morning. At one point, I stood up and I said, in the name of Christ Jesus, let go of him.
She started up a couple times, and I had to tell her to stay back. And then even after this, she said, we're not leaving. And I said, yes, sure. So we got him cleaned up, got him dressed. She got dressed, and then we ended up taking him out.
Thanks to Berea College Special Collections and Archives for providing that audio. A longer version of that story is on our website at wvpublic.org. Stonewall Jackson Lake was completed in 1990 and is now used for boating and fishing recreation. It also provides flood control for areas downriver of the West Fork River. Although there is an exit off of I-79 called the Roanoke Exit, the town no longer exists. Along with Barbara Hevner's farm and nursery, it sits at the bottom of the Stonewall Jackson Lake. Just how common are stories like these? Do you have family that was affected by a lake project? How do you talk about these projects? We want to hear your story. Send us a tweet to In Appalachia or send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. You know, in Central Appalachia, there are more than 30 man-made lakes built and maintained by the Army Corps of Engineers. Across the United States, there are more than 700 man-made lakes created by dams. We've been focusing on loss of land from these lake projects, but what about natural plant and animal species, or even archaeological sites? Some projects to build dams have come against pushback from historians and environmentalists. That's true in Kentucky's Red River Gorge, where a dam was almost built. It's been said that the Red River Gorge is Kentucky's own version of the Grand Canyon or Yosemite Valley. Unless you're driving the back roads looking for it, it's easy to miss.
Right about here is where the road will disappear. The river wraps like a snake around Clay City. It's just one of those things, like you said, you learn to adapt. And a couple times a year you get a new lake and you admire it and it goes away.
That's sound from a radio documentary produced in 2016 about a controversial project that almost flooded the Red River Gorge in Kentucky 50 years ago. The documentary starts with a tour by former Powell County Red River Floodplain Director Corey Graham, who's pointing out the areas of Clay City that have been flooded many times over the years.
Everything in this area that you see and everything we've seen could, in the blink of an eye, be submerged in water. And then maybe not to the extent that you've seen in New Orleans or areas like that where people are sitting on the roof, but to the extent that the damage is just going to be catastrophic. And we have a lot of people who really actively work to get themselves removed from the floodplain, if at all possible, if they're on the line, because the additional flood insurance, it can make or break a household income.
By 1954, the people of Powell County were asking the federal government for relief. By 62, the United States Army Corps of Engineers figured their best option was to create a flood control lake. But the area that would be flooded was the Red River Gorge, one of the most unique geological areas in the eastern United States. A few local citizens spoke out against the dam, but for the most part, residents of Powell County supported the project. And by 1967, it seemed like a done deal. But then, the newly formed Cumberland chapter of the Sierra Club helped organize a protest. One of the local residents who was working with the Sierra Club, Carol Tishner, suggested they invite an avid outdoorsman who also happened to be a U.S. Supreme Court Justice, William O. Douglas, to hike the gorge and help raise awareness.
And I said, well, that's who we need to draw attention to the Red River Dam. That's what we've been looking for. Well, he said, I don't much agree with that. He said, that's a little stream. And he said, Douglas is Supreme Court Justice, and I don't think we'd ever get him down to look at a little stream in Kentucky. And I said, well, you never know till you ask him.
Well, it worked. Justice Douglas showed up. He agreed to visit Kentucky and make an appearance at the protest hike in November 1967.
I'd say there's 800 to 1,000 on that hike, and it was probably 200 or 300 opposing it on the other side. So there was a lot of people there. But the other thing was interesting, Diane Sawyer, a young reporter at the time, with a huge television camera, photographing everybody as they jumped across a little stream there.
Let's pick back up with Charlie Baglin here, who produced and narrated this radio documentary called Kentucky's Red November.
Oscar Geralds, an attorney from Lexington, said landmarks in that area are a part of the local vocabulary. Rough Trail, Pinch 'em Tight, Sheltoy Trace, Gray's Arch, and others would be forever changed. For those on the outside looking in, the visit from Justice Douglas gave the Red River Gorge a face and a voice.
Yeah, I had my scout troop down there. Seemed like a pretty good crowd, but there were locals there, some that didn't want us. But there was a lot of young people, students. We went with him part of the ways. We didn't do the whole hike with him because I had 15 little boys I had to take care of, too.
What do you think was the turning point?
Oh, my gosh. That may have been it, that day. Because that was when we first got any publicity. I think people figured, if a justice of the Supreme Court's interested, it must be fairly important.
So the Sierra Club had the attention of Washington and Frankfort, enough at least to delay the project to give ecologists and archaeologists the chance to further review and to probe a possible alternate site for the dam. Meanwhile, the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife was in place, as well as other state natural resource agencies. On the federal side, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service. But deeper levels of regulations were also in the offing. Our bald eagle was facing extinction. Hence, new laws to protect the nation's endangered species were being drafted and enacted in 1973. The Environmental Protection Agency was established in 1970. And one more.
This dam was proposed before the National Environmental Policy Act was even law, which was passed in 1970.
NEPA, Tim Ealing mentions, stands for the National Environmental Policy Act. It was one of the first laws ever written that establishes the broad national framework for protecting our environment. NEPA requirements would now come into play on all large federal projects, airports, military complexes, highways, and yes, dams to create lakes. In many respects, this time period was seen as the birth of environmentalism.
Oh, it was new there. I remember I bought some of the first books on environmental law that had come out. It was a new field.
And you were setting standards.
I may have been, I didn't know it.
Attorney Oscar Geralds represented the Sierra Club as president of the Red River Gorge Legal Defense Fund, and he quickly became an unpopular man in Powell County. Soon after the protest hike with Supreme Court Justice Douglas and for years to follow, the story appeared in national media, including the New York Times, CBS News, Time Magazine, and Smithsonian Magazine, allowing the small river in Kentucky to flow across the national stage. At the core of the matter were differences on what impact a dam would impose on the area being flooded. Dr. Bill Martin, who would later in the 1990s serve as the commissioner of the Kentucky Department for Natural Resources, was in his first years of teaching basic biology at Eastern Kentucky University.
Oh yes, the environmental impact statement, the entire controversy. That was the reason I took the students to begin with. We're talking about, Charlie, a time in Kentucky in which there was no Nature Preserves Commission. There was very little field research being done by anybody except the fish people. And that what we knew about the landscape was quite minimal, quite frankly.
Among the supporters of the Stop the Dam effort were students. And the students' presence grew as the controversy grew. Not just because protesting was common in these days, but the gorge itself was an outdoor classroom.
Well, four major habitats. You had the habitats of the stream, the floodplain, slope, and had the habitats of the ridge tops. So it was fairly detailed discussion of it that I did. Talk about the controversy and to have them read the environmental impact statement. I had certain assignments and had an exam. But the way the Corps had written the ecological impacts and this sort of thing, to my knowledge, they didn't hire any consultants to do the job. It was written as if engineers were writing it in the first place. It was written by people who didn't know basic evolutionary theory. The one thing they stated was that the rising waters would not affect the vegetation because the plants would adapt to it. And all of these upland species, of course, would have died as a result of the permanent flooding.
To many, Powell County and neighboring cities who would tap the lake for drinking water, such as Lexington and Maysville, the Sierra Club was evil. How could they wonder? And to those who sought to protect the natural beauty and the biological diversity of the area, the Corps of Engineers was the bad guy.
We've been listening to an excerpt of a radio documentary by Charlie Baglin about a proposed project in Kentucky's Red River Gorge. This story was a production of the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife. As we just heard, the project created quite a controversy in the 1960s, pitting environmentalists against most of the local people of Powell County, who wanted the dam for flood control. In a minute, we'll hear more. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today we've been hearing about projects, several in West Virginia, that resulted in lakes in Braxton, Lewis, and Summers counties, and another in eastern Kentucky that would have resulted in the Red River Dam. But those who opposed the dam argued that the environmental impact study didn't take into account endangered plant and animal species in the gorge. Mike Turner with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is featured in the documentary.
Clearly, environmental reasons, which in our phraseology here includes archaeology and cultural resources. The definition of an under environment under NEPA includes both the natural and the human environment. So the primary reasons for Red River not being built, environmental concerns and impacts to archaeological sites.
One species of a wild plant that the dam would have wiped out is the white-haired goldenrod, which is found only in the Red River Gorge. Still, federal funding for the Red River Dam was approved. Let's pick it back up now with Charlie Baglin, host of Kentucky Afield Radio and producer of a documentary and the controversy over the Red River Gorge Dam back in the 1960s and 70s.
So, the controversy of Red River Gorge becoming Red River Lake was peaking with attention, including a young man's from Paducah.
Now, I'm from West Kentucky, so I'm from the opposite end of the state. I didn't really hear about it and become knowledgeable about it until I got in the legislature.
Julian Carroll was elected to the Kentucky House of Representatives in 1962.
But once you get in the legislature, and you start talking to friends from various sections of the state, you start learning about issues that are floating out there, we call them, that we know are going to float around in our direction one of these days. And so I had no idea in the early 60s that I'd be sitting in the governor's chair in 75 and have an opportunity to do something about the Red River Gorge.
And this weighed heavily on the gubernatorial candidate in the 1975 election. And the pressure was mounting on Governor Carroll from the Corps to state his opinion on the project, pro or con.
This became really quite a hot issue. And basically, there was a time frame on me. But the Corps of Engineers was ready to proceed with the project. And that's why there was so much heat on me at the time to either save as well as heat to go ahead and flood the Red River Gorge. For whatever you might want to make of politics at the time, politics was really not a major issue. I felt like that by the 75, when I made the decision, that I had accumulated the facts I needed to make the decision, and I made it.
Governor Carroll wanted to base his decisions on all the facts. He looked beyond the woods and beyond the waters to the human footprints of the gorge. What's in there, he wondered, that links us to our pioneer and Appalachian past?
I had an opportunity to save a piece of Kentucky that is indeed one of our major landmarks for people to see and enjoy.
The Kentucky Heritage Commission had discovered 18 archaeological sites that could likely place the area on the National Registry of Historic Places. But what really prevented the United States Corps of Engineers from simply following through on the project? As of April of 1975, nothing. In a letter from the Secretary of the Army Corps of Engineers, Secretary Howard Calloway writes, quote, "I've concluded that the environmental impacts have been adequately considered and that the Corps should proceed with the project," end quote. The Corps was prepared to begin land purchase negotiations with local residents within days.
I felt a leaning that I was going to have to stop that flooding of the Red River Gorge.
But the Corps indicated that a no-turning-back point was approaching as expenditures were being made. In the meantime, the Sierra Club, Oscar Gerald's, and the Red River Gorge Legal Defense Fund filed a lawsuit in federal court in Louisville. What they wanted was a temporary restraining order against land purchases, and Governor Carroll joined that suit.
I can distinctly remember going through line at the supermarket and having people behind me saying, "Now we're going to save the Red River Gorge, aren't we?"
So they were for it.
Yes, sir. They wanted to save it. And so, yes, I was getting a lot of public comment as I traveled the state to save the Red River Gorge.
By September, archaeologist reports were complete. And meanwhile, over in Louisville, Judge Bratcher in the federal court case had made a decision there.
I said, "I'm going up to the third floor of the mansion, and I'm going to closet myself, and I am going to make a decision, and I'm going to write it in longhand."
So finally, the decision was being made. In that federal court case, Judge Bratcher sided with the environmentalist, setting up full-scale hearings on the project's merits.
And I made the decision to veto the proposal of the Corps of Engineers, which by law, federal law, I had the authority to do.
The calendar read September 11th, 1975. Governor Carroll announced his decision. After careful review of the facts, he said, quote, "I find no compelling reason to build the Red River Dam."
And so we've preserved the Red River Gorge for its archaeological value, for its beauty, for people to see. I have no apology for having made the decision. I think it was the right decision when I made it. I think it continues to be the right decision.
The Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, and environmentalists near and far had won. The gorge was free to remain the gorge.
After the state withdrew its support for the project, that was it.
But was the governor's decision really enough? Backlash from Washington was that the project would still proceed. Though thrilled by the veto, the fear that many nature lovers held was, could this be overturned? Perhaps by a future governor who may be more sympathetic toward the lake idea, or possibly in Washington.
Well, I think the Corps was just sitting on it with the idea of coming back. They don't usually give up, and this was the first time I think anybody had really opposed them on one of their projects like that.
Congressman William Natcher, a key member of the House Appropriations Committee, said no further funding would be sought. Likewise, the Corps ended their interest in the project. But what the Sierra Club and other environmental factions wanted was assurance from the federal government. That assurance would come by having Red River officially declared a federal wild and scenic river.
We had designated it under the state law before, but in order to get that done, there had to be a provision in the bill that state designation would not block any dam. That's the only way you could get it through the legislature at all. So I wasn't real satisfied with that until we got the federal one.
Oscar Gerald's and company would spend another 18 years toward that end, ending the controversy twice and for all. The Forest Service, Tim Ealing.
You know, every once in a while you'll hear somebody talk about the old days and some people that I know that were around then, 1960s, when that battle was going on here, and you'll hear about that. But in terms of it ever happening, it would never happen again. Since 1993, the Red River was designated a federal wild and scenic river. And in that legislation, it said the river would be forever free flowing. So you can never have a dam with that federal legislation that took place in 1993.
We've been listening to a documentary about the controversy over the Red River Dam produced by Charlie Baglin of Kentucky Afield Radio, which is a production of the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife. This November marks the 50th anniversary of the protest hike in Powell County, Kentucky, that eventually caused the Army Corps of Engineers to halt construction on a major dam in the Red River Gorge. Roxy Todd spoke with Charlie about his documentary.
So why did you first become interested in the story about the Red River Gorge?
Well, I'd been a visitor to Red River Gorge all my life, hiking and backpacking and visiting and photographing. And we realized that it's been 50 years since this controversy began back in 1967, and few people really know the story. Some of the older generations, maybe they remember parts of the story, but there's a story out there that's simply going to fade into folktale if we don't tell it. And it's always nice to know the history of an area. It kind of makes it more meaningful.
So in your reporting, you kind of found that there's this us and them controversy back in the 60s, where the local people of Powell County really wanted the dam to help protect them against flooding. But environmentalists got involved and they wanted to protect the gorge. Tell us about the people who live here, who you met. Were you aware that, I guess, there was these deep-seated frustrations and tension between them and the outside environmentalists?
Had I been around 50 years ago, definitely I would have. Things have mellowed out a little bit since then. But what struck me, I guess, hardest was the sentiment of the home front. I grew up in a small town. It was on the Ohio River. Maybe 3,000 people lived there. Everybody knew everybody. An hour upriver was Cincinnati. An hour downriver was Louisville. And they were big cities. They had four-lane highways. They had airports. But for all that they were, they weren't the center of the world for me. But what was my little hometown. I had roots there. And the people of Powell County, Kentucky feel exactly the same. If you grew up in Clay City, which is basically where this episode, this program takes place, or maybe you grew up in Slade or in Stanton or some smaller community out somewhere in the county like Bowen or Nada or Roslyn, Bonds Mill, places that don't even have zip codes, but just a few houses and maybe a church. Well, this is where they live, and it's been this way for generations. This is their home. But families in Powell County also have this natural wonder in their backyard. And the Red River Gorge is that natural wonder, and sometimes it's a blessing and sometimes it's a curse. And when it rains, and I mean like a real soaker, you can count on flooding. You get used to it, though. It's not really a matter of liking it or not, or toughing it out. You just deal with it. This is home, and this is what happens at home. But everywhere you go, I don't care where, there's always pluses and minuses. When it's home, you make allowances, and you go on.
So today, when you talk with the people of Powell County, is there still a sense of resentment or frustration that they never got their dam?
Yes and no. Nobody wants to see downtown underwater. But at the same time, you have this marvel, the Red River Gorge, and they absolutely love it, just like anybody else would. And yes, they have had roads wash out and bridges wash away, and they have rebuilt them, and they have rebuilt a few higher and more secure than others. But still, no, it's in a flood zone area, and it will flood, and you will be reminded of that every time that it rains really hard for a number of days. In fact, there is a neighborhood there, beautiful area, beautiful houses. But when it rains, if you're in your house, well, you may be there for a few days. And if you're not in your home, you may be living elsewhere for a few days because the road between wherever you are and your home is underwater.
And they stay because of the connection to place, because it's their home?
It's their home. And you don't want to leave home. And it makes you look at what a home really is. Is it just a few rooms and a kitchen table? Or is it the mist in the morning valley? Is it the sunrise over the hillside? If you were raised out in the county, home is land. If you live in a home in the city, you like the street, you like the playground down the street. That's part of home. If you were raised in the county, it's all the land around you. There are old stories about how grandparents would teach grandkids, don't sell your land. Your grandmother lived in this house. Your grandfather farmed this land. This is yours. This is your identity. The world may crumble around you, but you'll always have this land. And that's part of the mindset that you're up against when it comes to selling some of that land to create, for example, a diversion channel to help remedy the situation of flooding in town.
That was Charlie Baglund, host of Kentuckia Field Radio, speaking with Roxy Todd. 50 years later, the people of Powell County still feel frustrated that they never got a dam to help protect them against repeated flooding. Hey, Roxy.
Hey, Jessica, what? Or what am I supposed to say, what?
What do fish say when they hit a concrete wall?
I have no idea.
Damn.
Good one.
Okay, ready. So there was a boy standing on a corner selling fish, and he was saying, damn fish for sale, damn fish for sale. A preacher walked up to him and asked why he was calling them damn fish. The kid said, well, I caught them at the dam, so they're damn fish. The preacher bought some, took them home, and asked his wife to cook the damn fish. His wife looked at him in bewilderment and said, preachers aren't supposed to talk like that. So the preacher explained to her why they were damn fish, and okay, she agreed to cook them. So when dinner was ready and everyone was sitting around down, and the preacher asked his son to pass him the damn fish. Well, his son replied, okay, cool. That's the spirit, Dad. Do you mind passing the potatoes?
I saw that one coming.
I kill me. And there you have it. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Michael Klein, Berea College, and the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife. Music in today's show was provided by Blue Dot Sessions, Seth Partridge, Fog Lake, Dr. Turtle, Jake Sheps, and Dinosaur Burps. Roxy Todd is our co-producer. Glynis Board edited the episode. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can email us at feedback@wbpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.